I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Natalie Douglas joins me now. The acclaimed chanteuse has just released a new album, Back to the Garden. It's a collection of golden age standards, pop gems from the Woodstock generation, with surprises along the way. All songs that demonstrate the vast range of Douglas's talents as a singer, performer, and interpreter of song. There are new big band arrangements of Cole Porter's Begin the Begin, a tender version of the ballad You'll Never Know, as well as a new take on the song Who. A rare song, He Lives in a World of His Own, written for Shirley Bassey by Lionel Bart, is on the album, and it's just delightful to hear it for once, but also to wonder what might have been. There's also a rock-inspired interpretation of Joni Mitchell's Woodstock, as well as a soaring anthem written just for Natalie by the founders of the Club 44 label, who released this album, Wayne Hahn and Joel Lindsay, Love is the Power That Heals Me. I'll ask Ms. Douglas about this album, the songs therein, and the craft of performing before a live audience, as she does. We'll also talk about the incredible research Natalie does for her popular shows, which she performs around the world, and at her home base, New York City's legendary Birdland Jazz Club. She is an expert instructor at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center, the Sullivan Foundation, and the Mabel Mercer Foundation. Visit nataliedouglas.com for more. We spoke nearly 1 month ago. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Natalie Douglas. Ms. Douglas, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed the album because there's a great variety of music on here. You know, the Great American Songbook, obviously, that you're well acquainted with and have performed for years. There's pop as well as Woodstock. In terms of putting an album like Back to the Garden together, I mean, what was the idea of the songs that you would include in an album like this? Because, I mean, you could have had an album twice the size, say, or you could have had it just Cole Porter, even. What was the process in terms of choosing what would be on Back to the Garden?
Well, it was actually a lot of fun, but it was a bit daunting. We started with a list of 63 songs that I love, and really wanted to record. Some of these songs on the album are songs that people have been asking me for several years. I do a lot of live performing all over the States and in the UK. And after concerts, when I'm selling the CDs, the three previous CDs that I had, you know, people will ask if a certain song from that concert is on this CD. You know, which CD has that song on it? So there were a few songs that people have asked me for repeatedly. And so those are on the list. And a couple of those, Woodstock and The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, are on this album. It also, I actually came up with the title very quickly when I was talking with the label about what this project would be. And once we decided on the title, because we knew Woodstock would be on it, then it became really clear to me that I wanted to record a lot of the songs that helped to form me as an artist. And that's what Back to the Garden means to me, the sort of creative garden from whence I sprung. Because my parents had this really terrific, eclectic record collection. And I grew up listening to Great American Songbook and show tunes and blues tunes and country and pop and, you know, 70s music in L.A., which is where I'm originally from. So, you know, it's this mixture of music that I've always listened to and always loved.
And I love the idea of it being a garden where this is where it started for you. This is where you heard a lot of this music for the first time. It's a wonderful idea for thinking about how our lives are shaped by the music we hear and how that influences us, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we all flourish when we get the chance to fall in love with music or books or the arts that sustain us, you know, as human beings. And so I do think of it as a garden, a wonderful place to explore and find the beauty and find the stuff that really resonates with you, you know. That's some of the magic in it, that we all have different tastes and there's something for everyone.
There's not a song on this album that I listen to and think she's not enjoying herself as she's performing.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it really comes through, and I guess that's why you had to pare it down from 63 to get to 11.
Yeah.
It does sound like a daunting task to have to do that. In terms of the lyrics, because, I mean, we can talk about music. I'm not a musician. I like listening to music, but I don't know how it works. But lyrics, I sort of understand because, you know, it's one of the first things I hear when I listen to a song. How important is finding yourself as a performer in the lyrics that you're performing?
Oh, I think it's key. I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of songs that I love, probably a million songs I love. Not all of them are songs I want to sing, though. Some of them are songs I enjoy listening to other people sing. But when it's a song that I want to sing, it's because I think there's a story in it in which I can express something, you know, something I can relate to. I think finding your way in a song is sort of the magic of singing material. I don't write, so I'm singing material that others have written. So finding my kind of voice in something that I didn't create from scratch is paramount to getting my take on a tune, you know. If I don't have that, I don't quite know how to perform it.
I'm curious to know, what do you hear when you sing? I mean, are you, there are different things that I think you're thinking about as you're performing. I mean, you're thinking of remembering the lyric and what note to hit. Do you think about, I mean, are you allowed to have your mind wander, if you will, when you're sitting in a room performing?
No, I don't do that. I mean, there may be people who do. For me, in this particular medium, I think one of the things that makes it really a form of communication between the artist and the audience is to have the experience that I'm singing about in front of you right now, you know. So I'm not wandering. I'm not thinking about the laundry or whatever. I am I'm thinking about what this feels like. You know, if I'm singing a song about heartbreak, I'm thinking about what that feels like. I'm envisioning specific moments. I mean, I tend to turn every song into a little film in my head. And so when I begin to sing, I picture the setting and the place and what's happening around me and what time of day it is and what time of year it is and what just happened in the scene before and what's, you know, what I want out of the scene that I'm expressing in the song. I was trained as an actor, so for me, every song is a monologue, you know, and I try my best to experience the true human emotion of which I'm singing. That's how I do it. I love the fact that a lot of artists have very different approaches. But I think that that's what works best for me. And I really hope, and in my strongest moments, I think that what I hear back from people is that, you know, they watch and hear me perform and oftentimes think, oh gosh, yes, I felt that too. You know, there's a sense of recognition. And that's certainly what I enjoy when I go see other performers. And when I was little and my parents took me to see a lot of live performance, that was certainly my impression of those moments, the great artists that I saw, Joe Williams and Nancy Wilson. You know, that they were singing a story that was personal, but it felt like we were having this one-on-one conversation and they were feeling things that I could feel, you know. And I really did have a moment as a little kid thinking that I want to do that, watching Joe Williams on stage. So that's what I try to do.
Yeah, and you do it so well that it translates to not just Back to the Garden, but I went back and heard a live recording of yours.
Yeah.
there is such a relationship between you and an audience. And the thing I'm curious about is I looked at your website, and you perform in New York City regularly at Birdland and other venues. You're going to London shortly. Is there a difference in terms of how, say, the musical sensibilities of an audience in Manhattan as opposed to, say, in England?
Slightly. I mean, there's a difference, of course, in the fact that every audience is different. Each audience is made up of individual people, and even when you play the same venue in the same town three nights in a row, you don't have the same exact audience all three nights. So every audience is different. And then there are certain subtle differences, like traditional differences. Years ago, we did a festival in Germany in the summer of, I guess that was 2014. And we took my Nina Simone tribute show there. It was my first time in Germany, my first time singing for that audience. And they were wonderful and really receptive, but no one told me that in this particular town, when they really, really liked something, they not only clapped, they also stomped their feet. And we were in this festival setting, so we were actually in a tent, mm-hmm. a permanent tent, but it had these kind of wooden risers that all of the seats were on, so that when they stomped their feet and clapped, it made this thundering noise. So, after, I think it was the fourth or fifth song, when that happened, I was startled. I had no idea what was going on. Somebody said, oh, it means they like it. I was like, okay, great, there are little differences, and certain things we've learned. Like, this will be I think this is my 12th appearance in London in the last 10 years. In the clubs in London, we always put in an interval. Mm-hmm. The clubs there much prefer it. So we reshape the shows and create sort of a first half, second half thing so that they can have a little break in the middle and go and, visit the facilities, order more cocktails, yeah. that sort of thing. So that was something new for me. I've never done that until then. Though I have done it since in a few venues outside New York in the States. But I think it's sort of one of the things that changes for me is sometimes I share a slightly different story because I love to do the research on the themes. I tend to do shows dedicated to one artist, mm-hmm. Sammy Davis Jr., Nina Simone, Dolly Parton, Joni Mitchell, Barbara Streisand, Cher, Dame Shirley Bassey, or a theme like an era. I have a 60s show called We Are Stardust. I have a show about songs from civil rights movements called Freedom Songs. And so I do a lot of research for any of these topics, way more than I could possibly put into an 80-minute show. And when I took the Sammy Davis Jr. show to London, since Sammy performed there so many times and was so popular there, I did have some stories that were specific to his London performances. So I featured those stories in those shows over there in a way that I didn't hear.
Yeah.
There's slight differences like that. And with the Nina show, when we first built the Nina Simone show, it was the year she died, which was 21 years ago. And I had done that show in that format many, many times all over the United States. And the first time we were invited to bring it to London was 2013. And we did a whole week there. And after the first couple performances, that Tuesday and Wednesday, those audiences really asked me for two songs that weren't in the show at that time. Mississippi Goddamn and Mr. Bojangles.
Uh-huh.
Songs I loved, but I just hadn't put them in the first iteration of the show. But they were so interested in them and so, serious about hearing them, we added them. By midweek, we added both of those songs. And they turn out to be now the two of the most popular songs I ever do when I bring the Nina show to anybody. We just did it for the first time in Cape Cod this past summer, the Cape Cod Jazz Festival. And again, those two songs were people's favorites. So, I feel like I learn from audiences wherever I go. I like to think of this as a dialogue. And I listen to what they have to say. And when they tell me that there's something they really want, I try and do it for them.
Yeah, and that speaks to this relationship that you've cultivated with audiences over the years, and why it's a very special relationship between you as a performer and the audience. You mentioned the research that you do for these tribute shows, and it sounds like a lot of fun, and you sound like you're having a lot of fun doing the research. But when you come up with a list of 80 songs, for example, for one artist, paring it down for the date, the show, that must be tough. I mean, you're probably breaking your heart every time you have to cut something that you want to do, right?
Yeah, of course. But I think it becomes easier because as I do the research, I tend to read all the bios. YouTube is an invaluable resource because so many of these artists have not only done performances that have been filmed and are now uploaded and available online, but they've done live interviews, you know. So you have, in essence, the horse's mouth telling you a story that you might not find anywhere else, you know. And as I do that, I begin to get a feel for the moments that were truly important to the artist. And so that can help to narrow down, oh, well, I have to sing that song because that song was the moment he discovered, you know, X, Y, and Z, or that song was the song that put him over the top, you know, kind of moment. I also know, like, when I'm doing a show about Dolly Parton, there are certain songs people expect to hear. So I want to deliver and give people those songs. But I don't want them to know everything that's coming at them. Because if you could program the show without seeing it, then why bother coming out? so I want there to be some surprises too. And I also know there will always be in these rooms people who know more than I, you know, who are super fans. And then sometimes there are people who don't know anything about the performer or even me. You know, one of the benefits to working in a legendary club like Birdland is that people come to that club on a Monday night at 7 p.m. When they happen to be in town because they've heard about it all their lives and they want to see it. Mm-hmm. And they don't know who's playing, you know, and so the entire evening is a surprise to them. So I know that I have to craft a show that'll be entertaining to all of these disparate groups of people. And I can't leave anybody out. I don't want anyone to feel like it's too inside baseball and they don't get what's happening, you know. But I also don't want the people who are already really, really well-versed in the artist to feel like it's all old hat and there's no revelation, you know. So I try and find the really, really interesting stories, the ones that are a bit off the beaten path. I always say that, you know, when you come to see one of my tribute shows, I am not going to read the Wikipedia page to you because that seems like a silly thing to charge you to do because you could do that at home and you don't even have to get dressed. Yeah. Stay in your PJs and do that. So I try to find the things that are a bit off the beaten path. When I built the Roberta Flack show the first time in 2019, there was no Roberta Flack bio at that point, and there was no TV special devoted to her. PBS American Masters did a program dedicated to her last January in 2023. But when I first built it in 2019, none of that existed. So I had to do all of that research from interviewing people with whom she'd worked and finding interviews online that she'd given and articles, magazine articles, newspaper articles. And I was really happy. I found a piece of footage of Luther Vandross talking about one of his first jobs in the industry before he was a solo artist. He was one of her backup singers.
Wow.
And he told the loveliest story about Roberta Flack being supportive and encouraging to him as he became a fledgling solo artist, you know. And it was beautiful. It was a gorgeous story, and I was so happy to find that kind of thing that was really personal about two artists I admire.
A song on this album that is a revelation, and I had enjoyed reading about how you found it, is He Lives in a World of His Own by Lionel mm-hmm. Bart. It's one of those songs on this album where you sound as though you're having a lot of fun doing it. As it starts, you know, it sounds like a James Bond song almost. Then I realized that this is a song in the album that, I guess Bart had written for Shirley Bassey. What was it like for you to find that song?
It was a thrill. I mean, that was when I was doing research for the Shirley Bassey Show. And she is someone about whom there are several biographies. So I read all of them, which is always fun because they usually contradict each other in some very yeah. important parts. And in one of the books, I read this story about how Shirley's then husband had been lobbying for her to get the role of Nancy in the film of Oliver. And that Lionel Bart loved the idea, and he was on board with it, and kept writing and rewriting material for her with which she could audition, you know, to convince the people in charge who were making these decisions and weren't on board. So he kept writing things that only Shirley could sing, you know, these big, glorious, melodramatic numbers. And so I was reading about these songs and then the fact that Shirley was so disappointed she didn't get the role, and that the songs never saw the light of day, you know. And I thought, oh, that's so sad. I wish I knew what those sounded like, you know. And in one of my deep dives on YouTube, I found a piece of footage from an Italian television special she did in the early 70s, I think. And it's funny because it's a little video, like kind of a proto music video, of her just walking on the beach and clips of her then husband and kids playing on the beach. That scene and all the scenes have nothing to do with the song, you know, but it is what plays in the background over this little scene. And I couldn't believe my ears. I couldn't believe that I was actually hearing this song that was sort of lost to time, you know. Yeah. And I played it for my music director, and who also happened to be one of my best friends, and he loved it as much as I did, and said, "Oh yeah, we definitely have to put that in the Shirley Show." So it's a part of the Shirley Bassey Show. We combined it with "As Long as He Needs Me" in that show, because it is very much the same song. You know, it feels like it's the same story told slightly differently. And I'm sure had Shirley gotten the role, it would have been one of the songs that they added to the musical. Because, you know, when you create a movie musical of a show that has been a musical before, in order to be nominated for a song to be nominated for an Oscar, it has to be a new song that was written just for the movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, all movie musicals that come from Broadway shows do that. And I'm sure that was one of the things that Lionel had an eye toward in terms of building a song. But instead, it didn't make the movie. It didn't make Shirley's next album, which I guess it was supposed to happen, but for some reason didn't. So I was really excited that the label was as thrilled by this song as I was. Wen Han, my producer, and Joel Lindsay, the A&R guy at the label, they both loved this tune when I played it for them. And then we were in the midst of recording it when we realized that it would actually be a kind of premiere.
Mm, yeah. You mentioned Lindsay and Han. They wrote a song that's on this album, "Love is the Power That Heals Me." And I have to say, when I was listening to it, I didn't know it was a new song. It sounds like a song that's been around forever. What is it like to perform something that's new and at the same time has that sensibility that as someone who is used to performing great songs and sometimes old songs, this new contribution to the craft, if you will, to the art form?
Yeah, it was a thrill. I mean, I have been a fan of their writing for a long time. They've written original songs for other friends of mine. I'm very fortunate that a lot of the other people on this label, on Club 44 Records, are friends of mine in real life. And they've written songs for their albums, of which I'm very fond. And so I kind of secretly hoped that that might happen, but I really didn't know that they were working on it until they presented it to me. And that was an absolute delight. And I love the song so much because it was so me. You know, I've known Wayne for several years now, 7-8 years. He actually was a fan of mine before we met because he happened to pick up my live recording of my Nina Simone show at a record store in New York years before we met. So we've had, you know, lunch, we've had dinners, we've chatted about life and the world and our perspective on things. And so that plus the conversations I'd had with Joel, I guess they were thinking about writing something for me, and they came up with this idea that is sort of how I look at the world and how I look at life. It is a very me kind of moment, which is wonderful and thrilling. And then the setting is so very Bacharach-y, that I love.
Yeah.
And I don't think they knew that one of my earliest formative experiences with music was sitting with my parents had a dear friend who was a neighbor, Paul Gayton, who had been a band leader in the 30s in New Orleans, and subsequent to that moved to Los Angeles and became a record label owner. And he was connected to A&M Records, but it was a separate label. The claim to fame on his label was Mom's Mabley, as his, she was a big seller. Yeah. But it was mostly a music label. And, he and his wife Odile threw the best parties, and, I was one of the few kids on the block at that time. My parents were much older when they adopted me, so all of their friends had kids who were out of the house. And so they'd throw these fantastic grown-up parties, and they'd forget that this little kid was running around, which was fantastic because then I'd hear things that little kids aren't supposed to hear. And I remember vividly sitting under the piano so I could listen to the music. They'd play and sing for each other. You know, all these artists would show up.
Yeah.
And this woman stood up. She was new to the label, and Paul was introducing her to the crowd and the neighbors at the party. And she sang her single from her first album, which is a Burt Bacharach song. And I remember sitting under the piano and hearing the sound of it and thinking, oh, yeah, this. I want everything about this. I want this. So I don't know that they knew that I had such a love of that sound, that Bacharach, that 60s, that really sort of fascinating, interesting chord choice thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's what they came up with. And it just felt like kismet, you know, that this was meant to be.
Yeah.
It's great fun to sing a good song, whether it's, you know, 99 years old, which, like the song Who, the Jerome Kern song on the album, or this song, which is literally a year old, you know?
Yeah. You're such a gifted performer, Natalie. What do you tell young people who might hear you or see you and say, that's what they want to do when they grow up? I mean, the other thing that's key, I think, to how successful you are is that the heritage of this craft, the performing, I mean, that's important to know, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, I do a lot of teaching. I'm an expert instructor for the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center every summer, and I'm executive education director for the Mabel Mercer Foundation. So I teach a fair amount when I'm, often when I travel.
Uh-huh.
There's a component where, you know, we do two or three concerts and then we do a class one morning, a workshop for, sometimes it's for teens, sometimes for adults. And I spend a lot of time talking about this work, and I love this work, and teaching and guiding, other people who love this work. And I always say, you know, there's kind of, you can never know too much about your song. You can never know too much about the people who created it, the people who wrote it, the people who made it famous, the circumstances, you know, because, like, like one of the things I talk about, I have a program that I take, I haven't done it in many years now, but for a while I would take programs into schools. And one of them was a program kind of about how if you listen to the music of a particular era, it can tell you what's going on societally, culturally. You know, the music of the 1940s, World War II era. The poetry of those songs is very different from the poetry 10 years earlier, because the things people were writing during World War II are very different than the things people were writing during the Depression. They both reflect the times in which they live, but, you know, they have a different flavor. And if you, as an artist, all these years later, are singing that song, you need to have a sense of why it was written. Even if your take on it is different, you still need to know what the intention was.
Yeah. I mean, even a song like True Colors, which we all know, it takes on a new meaning. But you're certainly cognizant of the context in which that song was performed and the message then as now, right?
Right. Well, and now, I mean, I was saying to everybody last night that this song has, I've known it forever, of course, and I love it, and I think it's brilliant. I had never thought of singing it, and Wayne, my record producer, suggested it for our song list. And I said, yeah, let's try it. Why not? I love the song. And once I started singing it, its import landed on me even more so. And in the last couple of weeks, every time I've sung it as we have been rehearsing for the state, you know, I can't help but think of the kids, in particular, you know, Nex Benedict, who was tragically murdered in a bathroom because people didn't accept their identity. And, you know, the kid Daryl George in Texas, one of our kids who the Texas judicial system has told him that he has to cut his locks because his school says so, you know, and all of these people who are because they don't approve of a kid's identity, the length of a kid's hair, what a kid cares about or loves, you know, are trying to change kids, are trying to erase them, are trying to hurt them. And I can't sing this song without thinking about how every one of those kids deserves to see themselves and know that they're beautiful the way they are, and that they should be loved for the way they are, not shunned or hurt or murdered or excluded. You know, they should be celebrated because we're all weird and we're all different and we can't conform because nobody's normal. You know, I mean, there's no such thing. So I can't help but think, even though the song is 38 years old, it's something that we need to hear over and over again, and certainly I need to sing.
Yeah, it's a great record on a cut on the album as well. It just sounds beautiful in your hands, your voice. I could talk all day with you. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the album. It's such a great album, and congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it. So I so appreciate your time today, Natalie. All the best.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. You take good care of yourself, okay?
The website for more is at nataliedouglas.com. The album is called Back to the Garden. It's from the Club 44 label. It's singer, artist, star, Natalie Douglas. Join me on the line from New York City and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.